This is the fifth shiur in Hilchos Shiur of the Rambam. We are going to continue a few ideas in chapter 1 before we go back to chapter 2. I want to add a few comments on a number of ideas in chapter 1. I'm not going to go through all of it systematically, but there are a few ideas here which I can expand upon and make and say something useful about. In Halacha Gimel, in the third paragraph, the Rambam says, in the times of the temple, there were the sacrifices, there was the so-called scapegoat, and then there was a whole complicated order of how things worked. In our times, he says, well, there's no temple, there's no altar to be part of the kapara, cleansing process, there's only tshuva. Now, tshuva Chaperes al kol averos. Tshuva cleanses. Sometimes they write atones, but lechaper in Hebrew really means to cleanse. Cleanses for all transgressions. All transgressions. No such thing as a transgression that's so serious, a crime that's so heinous that tshuva doesn't work. Tshuva works for everything. Even if he's wicked all of his days and does tshuva at the end, nothing of his transgressions will be remembered or mentioned to him. He quotes a verse. As I told you, every move here, every move he quotes a verse. And the day of Yom Kippur itself, the very day, also cleanses to those who do tshuva. There's no magic in the 24 hours. It's not just living through the 24 hours that gets you some kind of cleansing. Those who do tshuva, Yom Kippur cleanses. Now, already one could ask, if tshuva does the job, so what's left for Yom Kippur to do? The next halacha explains in great detail. Even though tshuva cleanses and the day of Yom Kippur cleanses, there are those transgressions which are wiped out, cleansed immediately, and there are those that which are wiped out or cleansed afterwards, after time. There are different categories of transgressions, and although, now listen carefully, although all you need to do is do tshuva, the effect of your doing tshuva isn't always instantaneous, and the effect of you doing tshuva may require other conditions to help it along. It's just that all you need to do is to do tshuva. Now he divides transgressions into four categories. It's a Mishnah in Yuma. He's quoting that Mishnah, and it says as follows. How does this work? If a person transgressed a positive commandment, which carries no penalty of kares, of being cut off divinely, and he does tshuva, he's forgiven and cleansed instantly, although here he uses the word mochlin, we may get to that. He's cleansed instantly. The tshuva is effective immediately. If he violates a negative commandment, also that does not imply kores, meaning divinely cut off, a simple negative commandment, if he does tshuva, Tshuva is tola. Now, tola usually means to hang. It's like hanging something up on a hook. It's still there. It's still there, but it's hung on the hook. It's not operative. It's not active. It hasn't disappeared, but it's not operative or active. Tshuva hangs it up, and Yom Kippur cleanses it. He quotes another verse. So let's say a person goes through a whole day without putting on tefillin. That's a positive commandment. He's violated that positive commandment. If he does tshuva, he's cleansed immediately. Suppose someone has that infamous bacon cheeseburger, which is a simple negative commandment. Then he, if he does tshuva hangs it up, suspends it, one might say. And then when Yom Kippur comes, it's wiped out. If he violates a commandment which carries the penalty of being cut off by God or death in a court, then tshuva and Yom Kippur together hang it up, and suffering cleanses. And he quotes a verse. And all of this supposes that he did not defile God's name. If he defiled God's name, then tshuva, Yom Kippur, and suffering all suspended, and death cleanses. So, the bottom line here is that if a person does tshuva, he leaves this world clean. That's true across the board. He leaves this world clean. He leaves this world without any liabilities. Only, when the cleansing is effective depends upon the kind of transgression it is. For a simple positive, it's immediate. For a simple negative, it's only after Yom Kippur goes by. For a more serious positive or negative, it's tshuva, Yom Kippur, and suffering. And if God's name is desecrated, then it requires tshuva, Yom Kippur, suffering, and death. Okay, first little detail to clarify. Suppose a person performs the transgression in January and dies in February. And there was no Yom Kippur. Suppose it's one of categories 2, 3, or 4. So the other commentators all say that death wipes out everything. It's not necessary to have Yom Kippur in between. It's just that Yom Kippur can speed things up. If it's, let's say, the cheeseburger, and he does tshuva and Yom Kippur goes by, he doesn't have to wait for death. He's cleansed right away. Suffering, same thing. Suffering is included in death. And that being the case, if it was a type of transgression that needed suffering, death will take care of it. Of course, when we talk about the longer cases, the cases that require time, it means that he remains with his tshuva. He doesn't take back his tshuva, doesn't regret it, stays with his tshuva. But the bottom line is what I said, told you before. All the person has to do is tshuva. Then he's guaranteed to leave the world clean, though other things may have to happen in order for that cleansing to come. That's point number one. Point number two, what does it mean it's suspended, hung up? Person performs a transgression, those transgressions have power. They have effects. Unattended, they can have effects. Like the Mishnah says, mitzvah gereres mitzvah, but aver gereres aver. When a person does a mitzvah, that sets up a power which will lead him to do more mitzvos, that's one shot. And a person who, Rachman HaSan, does an aveir, does a transgression. So that transgression is a reality which will lead him to do more aveiros. Does tshuva, that's suspended. There are certain types of transgressions which entail a punishment in this world. Does tshuva, for a simple transgression, that power is suspended. If it's a more serious one, then tshuva and Yom Kippur suspend it and won't have those effects. If it's a more serious one, then it requires suffering. So the suspension means the normal impact, the normal power that transgression has to affect his life is suspended until the wiping out process takes place. Yeah?
What would be a more serious transgression?
Murder. murder, anything that would require a death penalty, or being cut off by God. So murder, or violating Shabbos, or eating forbidden fats, or, I mean, there's a whole bunch of them that have this. Mishnah says there are 36 certain types of forbidden sexual relations, kidnapping. I mean, there's a whole bunch of them. I mean, any of them that has these types of death penalty, either human death penalty or divine, so to speak, death penalty, any of them would be more serious, and then you'd require Shuv and Yom Kippur to suspend it and suffering to make it happen.
Is there a different category for the ones that you're supposed to die before due?
No, not so far as I know. That's a different side. They're just they're in category three, but they're not a separate category for this classification. Now, I must tell you, the Ramchal, Moshe Rabbeinu Sato, seems to have a different view about this, and I'm a little surprised. I don't think he mentions the Rambam, and the Rambam is quoting a Mishnah in Yuma. In the Mesilas Yesharim, in the Path of the Just, Chal says, yes, indeed, to be cleansed of a person's transgressions generally requires suffering. But, he says, real tshuva requires regret. And regret is painful. A person who does tshuva adequately and regrets his crime, that's suffering enough. No other suffering is required. Clearly the Rambam is not saying that, because he has tshuva, and then suffering is added to the tshuva. So how to reconcile the Rambam with the Ramchal, I don't know. I'm just telling you that if it is truly a contradiction, I don't see how to reconcile it, and I want you to know there's another view. A deeper problem, and one which I will comment on, but I don't have a full solution to, is this. The idea of suffering as cleansing transgressions is not a simple idea. It's not an easy idea. The Rambam says that for category three, you must have suffering. You must have suffering. Not everyone agrees to that. The Rabbeinu Yonah in the Shari Tshuva says either suffering or increased mitzvos. He says it explicitly. Charity, learning Torah, other mitzvos. Either way, he says. So there is a difference of opinion as to whether suffering is necessary. That's another detail. The deeper problem here, and I'm worried about this problem because I didn't see anybody raise it. And that always worries me. It means it probably has some simple solution that I haven't thought of. Deeper problem here is, how is suffering relevant? How is suffering relevant? He ate a cheeseburger, so we'll boil him in oil. I mean, okay, you could do that, but why would that be relevant? Why should anybody care about that? Why would that be the remedy for the crime? So if he's in this world and you want to punish him as a disincentive, he shouldn't repeat it, I can understand that, but it's not always in this world. It can be the prelude to the world to come. It could be in Gehenna. There's got to be something intrinsic in the suffering that cleanses him from the results of the crime. To me, it is not intuitive at all. I heard one explanation given sort of offhand in another context, that the person that did the transgression enjoyed it, so the enjoyment he had in the transgression has to be compensated for by suffering. Even that I don't really understand. I understand that, you know, you could balance them up, but why would that be the right way to do it? So he enjoyed himself, so why? For example, to me it would be much more natural to say, if he stole money, let him give money to the poor. Why should he, you know, get bee stings all over his body? What's it got to do with stealing the money? How did that help? How is it relevant? Well, okay, Yisurim in Hebrew usually means either physical suffering or tragedy, God forbid, you know, it means pain.
Like, there's this commercial with the Marines that says, pain is weakness leaving the body. So,
pain is weakness leaving the body?
That's the Marine.
I mean, that means when you are commanded and succeeding in overcoming it.
Yes, so that's painful sometimes to people when they grow. That could be pain.
Yeah, but that's not what Yisurah means. It could be a subcategory, but he would have to specify it more precisely than saying Yisurah. Yisurah, a person's house falls down, or he gets a disease, or he loses a function of a limb, or... I mean, Yisurah is straightforward in that sense. Question is why is it relevant? Yeah.
It could be that the pain enhances the regret.
Oh. Okay. I want to go in that direction. I have a bit to say about it, which was all speculative, but I want to go in that direction. But you see what he's doing, he's linking it to something which I know is part of the tshuva process. And if you can do that, then maybe you can get an explanation. I think that's the right move intellectually to make. I'll tell you what I think. But as I said, I haven't seen anybody raise the question. That really bothers me. I'm using now some things that the Ramchal says in other places, putting two and two together, hopefully getting four, not 16. What does it mean that a person does a transgression deliberately? God told me not to do this, but I'm doing it anyway.
So no
respect. Well... we're not talking about necessarily someone who does it brazenly. He may be struggling with himself. He knows it's wrong. You know, God told him not to do it. And yet, he does it. The mental set of the person is something like this. There's something over here that's desirable. But God said, don't have it. It's a pleasure. It's an advance. It's a profit. But God said, don't have it. Okay? God said don't have it, so I know I shouldn't have it. But it's really desirable, and that's why I'm struggling. Desirable means that it has some value, even if only to give me pleasure. To me, it has value. But God said don't have that value. Now let's see. Does that mean that God is denying me something that's good? Isn't God the source of all good and only the source of good? Could there be something which is really good that God would say no to? Couldn't be. But then where does my desire for it come from? My desire for it comes from the fact that I don't feel that all good in the world comes from God, and therefore if anything doesn't come from God, it can't be good. I don't feel that. I may know it intellectually, but it's a gigantic gap between the head and the heart. Gigantic gap between I know intellectually what I feel. And when my feelings impel me to do that wrong action, my feelings are saying is, there's something over here that's worth having. And my head says, yeah, but God said not have it. Okay. So that's why I'm struggling. But that feeling that's implied in the desire to have it is, there's something over there that has a value. And that means in a deep way, to miss the fact that God's will contains all good. It's a turning away from God as if to find something good outside of God. It means that there's an element of idol worship in a very diluted sense. There's an element of idol worship in every transgression. In every transgression, an element of there's something other than God that really has value. Well, if it's something other than God, where did it come from? It came from someplace else, right? And then someplace else delivered something that's really valuable, right? So then there's something else that's worth relating to, worth taking into account, worth perhaps dedicating oneself to part-time, you know, from time to time. Your mind is split. It's divided between God and something else. Or your feelings are split. Okay. Now, Rav Dessler, see, I'm putting two and two together. Dessler says in his Neis V'Teva and Bitochon, he says that a person is attached to something, something wrong, something bad. One way to detach him is that that bad thing causes him pain. Even if he's entranced by that bad thing and he's hypnotized by it and he's sold to it, if it causes him enough pain, often, I would even say usually, it can bring him to detach. We know, hopefully from observing others, when people get involved in relationships, and you, standing outside, can see that the object of the relationship is trashing this guy. You know, she doesn't care for him at all. She's using him. And he's blind. He's got stars in his eyes. And we say, and you say to him, look, you know, she's stepping all over you. She doesn't care about you. When she's finished with you, she'll throw you away. Drop her. And he says, she loves me, and I love her. And, you know, we'll get over it, and I'll make it up to her. And you say, he's nuts. He's nuts. That's true. He really is nuts. He can't see the truth. However, when she trashes him once, twice, three, four times, usually, eventually, that breaks the spell. If it causes you enough pain, then you come to think differently of it. But this is talking about teva there, about nature. People believe in nature. If they get hurt enough by nature, then they may turn away and think maybe there's something else. Maybe if the suffering can be identified as coming because of the transgression, then it's a way of forcing the person to turn away, saying, you went after this because you thought it had value. You went after this because you thought it would provide for you a pleasure or a benefit or a profit. It's ruining you. It's destroying you. If he sees that, then maybe he can turn back and overcome that split mind. Oh, so it isn't true. There can't be something outside of God which is really good. Then all of good is relocated where it belongs, in God's will. One's attached to God and only to God. Now, to go into the world to come and to be Nehne Miziv HaShchina, to enjoy God's presence, one has to be focused on that. If one's mind is split, so then one can't focus totally on that. The pain here could heal the split in the mind to the point where the focus is restored, and then it becomes a process whereby the person can truly appreciate the world to come. Okay, yeah, you can probably see that I worked on this for a while. And I put Ramchal together with Dessler, and I put two and two together. I haven't seen any obvious problems with it. Is it true? Maybe. Along with a lot of other things, maybe. But at least, what I want to do is, I'm sharing an idea with you, but mostly I want to sensitize you to the problem. The use of suffering to cleanse after a transgression is agreed upon by all sources. Rabbi Yonah disagrees whether it's necessary or not. And Rabbi Chal talks about how much it has to be. But the use of suffering is agreed upon by all sources. And to my mind, that requires some kind of explanation. Okay, all together. I guess that's all I want to do. Yeah. Well, if I understand you correctly, you're making a point which is very important for us, very dear. Where's my watch? I'll say a little bit about this. There's a gigantic debate in ethics generally and in the idea of a penal code that people are penalized for crimes. It's a gigantic debate whether what you're doing is penalizing the person for his past crime or investing in his future, or both. Retributive justice, retribution, you did something bad, you're going to get hit. Or preventing him from doing it in the future, or educating him or something, or both. I think, contrary to what you learn in philosophy class and what's popular in current political fashions, I think our intuitions register both. Here's Al Capone, shooting up his enemies, extorting money from widows and orphans, burning down businesses, you know, running rum and addicting people to alcohol. He falls down the stairs and is paralyzed from the waist down. How do you feel? I feel terrific! Wow! He got what he deserved. That's terrific. My only complaint is, why didn't it happen sooner? You know, but let's say he dies 2 minutes later. That's great. He should spend the end of his life suffering. That guy, he deserves to suffer. I think that's a root moral intuition. As much as they tell you, and the liberals embarrass you that it shouldn't be right, but that, in terms of moral intuitions, by the way, morality, all you have is intuitions. There isn't anything else. All moral philosophy does is play one intuition off for another and try to organize them and get the majority of intuitions. There's no external lever by which you can judge things of morality. On the other hand, we all recognize that what we do should have good effects for the future. in almost all cases, or maybe all cases, in Jewish sources, it's future-oriented. It's future-oriented. It's designed to produce a better outcome. It's designed to contribute to the person's future. In almost all cases, the suffering that a person undergoes is not, you did it, so suffer. I won't discuss the exceptions now, but certainly for all of us and all the people that we know and all the people we can think about, if they do suffer, the suffering is an investment in the future. It's not just because they did something wrong. The idea of the retributive, and indeed, if the world would work out the way God wants it to work out, it wouldn't work. It would never happen. It's only when certain people fail too disastrously, and it's a tiny, tiny vanishing percentage of people to whom that happens, it might turn out that way. Even there, you might have an external future justification. But I'm just saying, your observation that suffering vis-a-vis the future is definitely a Jewish view. But not everybody shares that view, because people who say Al Capone fell down the stairs and he's paralyzed, that's terrific, they're not thinking of the future. Right. They're thinking of the past. He did it, he deserves it, period.
Right, this is the prevailing view of everyone, religious, non-religious, is that we need to punish this guy. He needs to suffer. He needs to die. He needs to go to jail forever. He needs that electric shock therapy.
Okay, I think people are split on this. I mean, well, certainly in university, you know, where the liberals aren't controlled by virtue of their mafia tactics, they will teach you that you shouldn't think that way, you shouldn't feel as primitive and savage and feel that way. So. But I think if one is honest, one's moral intuitions include retributive intuitions, and we also care about the future, and our psychology here is quite complicated, and no one has sorted it out in a consistent fashion, as is often the case in ethics. Yeah.
The prevailing view is he did it, he needs more than what he did. He died, he doesn't need to die right away, he needs to suffer before he died. You know, he killed, he doesn't need to die, he needs to suffer before we put him to death.
Okay, but I'm just saying that we have these intuitions. The problem with ethics is we have a lot of intuitions and they're not consistent. And we're struggling to make them consistent. That's what ethical philosophy is about. If they were consistent, then ethicists would be out of business. Not likely to happen soon. Okay, let's go back to chapter 2. We had started paragraph 7, where we said that Yom Kippur is the end of forgiveness, pardon and forgiveness, and therefore everybody has to do tshuva. There's some details about when one should say the confession. The text, the minimum text of the confession is, the Rambam says this is the text that the whole of the Jewish people is accustomed to use, is we have sinned. That's the fundamental part of the confession. Now, just check here. In our version, we say a little bit more. We say we and our ancestors. Avanachnu vavoseinu chatanu. We and our ancestors have sinned. That's really mysterious. Let's think. Confession is one third of tshuva. Who's doing tshuva? I'm doing tshuva. What am I doing tshuva for? For what I did? Could I say, here's my confession, George sinned. Who are you to confess George's sin? You know, it's a little bit ridiculous, right? Maybe when we say we sinned, so then it's all of us together standing in front of you and confessing as a group. But certainly not that I'm confessing his sin. It's none of my business. I'm not competent to do that. How could the present group say we and our ancestors have sinned?
It's because basically you're telling Hashem, you know, our forefathers weren't perfect either, so how can you expect us to be perfect?
Wow. It's a clever idea, but I'm now confessing my sin. That's a clever idea, but it's a little different. There's a big difference between justifying myself on the one hand and confessing guilt on the other hand. Here I'm confessing guilt. To introduce a clause which says, "This is not really, I'm not really so guilty, you know, I have an excuse," that's not that part of confession of guilt. Yeah.
You're confessing your sins for your past lives as well, in essence, covering all your bases.
Ooh, that's a nice thought also. I haven't seen that, but that's definitely relevant. Our ancestors include the previous stages of all of us, right? But then it might be exclusive, right? Maybe this generation doesn't have in it any reincarnations of that generation. But it was a nice thought. It's a nice thought, yeah? Just as he did to them.
Yeah.
Now see what he did? He twisted your remark into a confession. It's a plea for mercy. A plea for mercy is a confession. You were making an excuse that maybe I wasn't so bad. So that's another clever move. It would be relevant, but this really isn't the time when you're asking for mercy. That comes later. This is where you're just saying what I did wrong. There is a metaphysical idea. But I'm interested. Your thoughts are good thoughts. There's no question about it, yeah? Yes.
By our ancestors.
Good. Yes, I think that's right. There are sins that were not atoned before by our ancestors. But my question is, why am I competent to confess their sin? If they did it, they should confess it. Okay, then it's just lost. You know, I think something else, yeah? You can feel it's much stronger, okay, but I need the platform which will give me the feeling. I thought you were going in that direction. What about considering the identity of the people, the Jewish people as a whole? Maybe there's a single thing called the Jewish people which has stages. And we are the present stage of this single people. So it's just like when I'm 52, I can confess what I did at 33. I'm just older. So this stage of the Jewish people can confess crimes committed by the Jewish people because we're a single entity in time. Let me give you some examples of what I mean. General Motors signs a contract with Zaire to provide them with trucks for 25 years. After 17 years, all of the board of directors, the CEO and the GEO and the PEO and all the rest of them have already been replaced. And all the shareholders have changed. All the people who own shares have sold shares. Now it's a brand new group of people. Could General Motors then say, we're not the same corporation? None of the old people is here. So we don't have to fulfill the contract as that year? They can't say that. Because a corporation isn't a group of people. A corporation is a certain legal structure, and even if you change all the people, it's the same corporation. Same thing's true with a country. The United States signs a treaty with Mexico in 1913. Well, you know, it's 2007. Must I live up to that treaty? A treaty about trade, or where the border is, and so forth and so on. I wasn't alive when that treaty was made. My representatives didn't vote on that treaty. What's got to do with me? The answer is, though you weren't alive, it was a treaty between the United States of America and the Republic of Mexico, and they still are here. These are corporate entities, and people function as stages in this one corporate entity. God made a covenant. Gosh, it's next week's parsha. Nitzavim. God made a covenant. It says explicitly there, I'm making a covenant with the people, not individual Jews, but with the people. And therefore, if you read the text carefully, it says that's why future Jews are bound by it. Otherwise, you could have the same question. So my ancestors, 3,300 years ago, made an agreement with God. They're gone. I'm a new person. How does it affect me? The answer is, God made a covenant with the people. The people are still here, even though individual humans have gone and other humans have taken their place. Okay. Indeed, Indeed, this reflects itself. I'm going back to an idea that I heard from Rabbi Soloveitchik, Oliver Sholem, many years ago. We have a rule, a chatas, a sin offering, whose owner has died, can't be used. It can't be used. Suppose you designate a communal sin offering. There are such things. We bring them on all the holidays. And from the time you designate it to the time you offer it, one Jewish person dies. Well, since that sin offering was supposed to represent the whole people and one of them has died, why not say that you don't have all the owners alive anymore and you can't use it? The Gemara says, Ein Tzibur Meis. The community doesn't die. Individuals die, but the community doesn't die. From which the following analysis is offered. When you say that that animal is representing all of the Jewish people, it isn't as if it's representing Reuven and Shimon and Levi and Yehuda. It's representing a nation whose citizens happen to be Reuven, Levi, and Shimon, and Yehuda. Right? And the nation didn't die, just individuals died. They're related to it as a nation. Rabbi Soloveitchik pointed this out when they made the Second Temple. They brought sacrifices for the sins of people in the First Temple. 70 years went by. There were a few people who were still alive, but the vast majority of people were gone. But Ein Tzibur Meis, the congregation, the community of the Jewish people doesn't die. So when you say, Avol Anachnu Ve'Aviseinu Chatanu, we and our ancestors have sinned, the saying that my ancestors have sinned can mean I now am the present stage of the Jewish people and I'm confessing what the Jewish people did in a previous stage. It's a little bit like, to move to a flippant example, when an American will tell a Brit, don't forget that we won the war. Right? Which war? We? Who's the we that won the war? You were fighting against the British in Gettysburg, in Valhalla? No, the Americans won the war against the British. But he can say, we won and you lost. Because it's still America. It's still the United States of America and it's still Great Britain. It's not a different country. It's not a different nation. Right? So that could be the simple explanation of this phraseology. We and our ancestors sinned. It's quite deep philosophically, as you see. Okay, let's get back here. Chapter 2. Okay, we're going to 9. This is an important thing. There's a little subtlety here. Tshuva and Yom Kippur only work. They only cleanse for transgressions between man and God. Like eating forbidden foods or having forbidden sexual relations and so forth and so on. But transgressions between people, like assault and battery, cursing one's friend, and stealing from him, and similar transgressions, a person is not pardoned at all, forever, until he repairs the damage to his friend, gives him whatever he's required to give him, and pacifies him. Tries to reawaken his goodwill. Even if he gives back the money that he stole, or that he owes, I shouldn't say stole, he gives back the money that he owes, because it could be damage, still he has to pacify him. And ask him, request from him, that he should forgive him. Even if he only irritated him with words, he has to pacify him, entreat him, until he forgives him. If his friend doesn't want to forgive him, pardon him, I'm skipping over certain subtleties in the vocabulary here, then he should bring him a group of three people of his friends, we assume the friends here means friends of the victim, and the transgressor entreats the victim in front of them and pleads with him. If he didn't agree, if the victim is still not willing to forgive, then he brings a group of people, a group of friends, a second time and a third time. If after three public petitions, pleading with his friend to forgive him, the victim doesn't forgive, then the criminal, the transgressor, can leave him and go his own way. And the one who refused to forgive is now the transgressor.
God doesn't forgive him.
Sorry, say again?
God doesn't forgive him.
Who?
The person that didn't forgive the other person.
Well, he's a transgressor. He says, "Hu achote." He's now the transgressor. He can do tshuva for what he did also. He can go back and ask him for forgiveness. I mean, he can always get out of it, but he's committed a sin by not forgiving him. Well, that's another thing. He's not referring to that here now. Mita keneged mita, what you're talking about. That's maybe true, but that's not the point that he's making here. However, if the wronged person is the Rebbe of the transgressor, he has to come to him even 1,000 times until his Rebbe will forgive him. That's a special relationship. The Gemara says that anyone who wrongs his Rebbe is as if he'd wronged God. There's a lot in that. Let me read to the end and maybe I'll come back and explain that some more. It's forbidden for a person to be cruel and not reconciled. A person should be easy to reconcile with. And it should be hard for him to become angry. Somebody asks, when the transgressor asks the victim to forgive him, he should forgive with a full heart and with a desirous soul. His attitude ought to be, I was just waiting for this. Thank you for doing this. Wonderful. I'm overjoyed that this happened. Even if the criminal, the transgressor, hurt him and sinned against him greatly, the victim should not take revenge and should not preserve in his heart the feelings, the frustration, the anger, of what he suffered. And this is the way of the Jewish people. Their hearts are right, and others are not like that. Now, let's, having said all of this, suppose A wrongs B and B dies. And A can't pay him back. Sometimes you can give it back to the heirs. Sometimes there are no heirs. Let's imagine someone who converts and doesn't have any children. He has no heirs. So what am I going to do? Pay it back to who? There's nobody there. Right? Ask him for forgiveness. So here's what you do. He takes 10 people and he goes to the person's grave and he says in front of them, I sinned to Hashem, the God of Israel, and to this person, and I did such and such to him. That's the Rambam's shita, that interpersonal transgressions should be said in public. And if he owes him money, he should pay it to his heirs if there are any. And if he doesn't know whose heirs are, he should put the money in the court, and he should confess. Now, this last is an illustration of what I told you a while ago, and in Yirtzeh Hashem, I'm going to go into it in much more detail. You have an institution called tshuva, and it has various parts and various rules and regulations. But doing part of it always counts. It's not an all-or-nothing proposition. And here, what you're really supposed to do is pacify this person. Get him to like you. Get him to change his point of view. And there's rules for that. He died and you didn't do it. You didn't do it. So does that mean you can't do tshuva? Because this aspect of tshuva you can't fulfill? No. You do what's left. You do what remains, what you can do, and that's enough. It's always, if you can't do any more, it's enough. And even if you could do more and you do part, the part is worthwhile. The part has a positive effect. Now, maybe I'll just finish by remarking a little bit on what it means when a person sins against his Rebbe. Chazal say that since we are told to honor God and to honor one's Rebbe, the honor that you give to the two of them is identical. That's what Chazal said. And the Shulchan Aruch quotes it. And the Taz, if I remember correctly, asks, could that be right? How could that be right? How could you give honor to any human being identical to the honor you would give to God? Our religion would... it's unthinkable. It's unthinkable. Yet the Taz proves, by various sources, that it's meant exactly that way. And the explanation is like this. I have a mitzvah to honor God. How shall I do that? What shall I do? If God would walk into the room, I would stand up. Okay, right, terrific, right. But, you know, he isn't your next door neighbor. So what am I supposed to do to perform this honor? That's one of the reasons God gave us a place called his house. If it's a place called his house, then by going to that house, purify myself before I go, and not going in with my money belt, and taking off my shoes, which are used for trekking, and dirty, and so forth and so on, and only going in to serve him, and so forth and so on, I can act out this honor. Otherwise, without opportunities, how am I going to do it? I'll give you a crude illustration. The king lives in the capital. It's 1,000 miles from your little village. We're talking about millennia ago. You want to honor the king. So, terrific, but what do? So you know what the king does? He puts up a statue to himself in the public gardens. And every time somebody walks past the statue, he takes off his hat. So talking about Goyim, right? He takes off his hat. That's how he expresses his honor for the king. Otherwise, how's he going to do it? If he would go to the palace, so then he would bow down and show his honor. But he's 1,000 miles from the palace. So there's got to be a representative of the king with whom he can interact. And by interacting with that representative, he shows his honor for the king. That's the key over here. A person who is a teacher of Torah and who's a guide for other people's religious performance represents God in the world. He's a representative of God in the world. And how you treat him is how you show your honor of God. That's why it's equal. It's not a question of equal in extent, but this is honoring God. That's why the commandment to honor God includes him. Right? Rabbi Kiva learns this from the verse, Es Hashem Elokecha Tira, have awe for God. And he says the S means to include Talmidei Chachamim, Torah scholars. Okay, maybe the S comes to add something, you know. Maybe it comes to add God on the festivals or something. I mean, how would you get the Torah scholars? The answer is because how you interact with the Torah scholars is the way you express your honor for God. Same is true with your parents in a certain regard, although less than scholars. So now, imagine a person